Today's Monday, August 26th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a surprise guest in France as President Trump and world leaders meet for the G7 summit.
It was quite a surprise. About 20 minutes out from landing, it appeared that the Iranian foreign minister's plane was on its way to Biarritz and was going to land at the actual site of the G7 meeting.
Growing concerns over thousands of wildfires burning in the Amazonian rainforest. Also ahead, former President Barack Obama releases his summer music playlist. It's all on today's International Edition. At a meeting of leaders of the most advanced democracies in France, deep divisions are coming out into the open between President Donald Trump and his counterparts on issues including the trade war with China, how to handle Iran, and bringing Russia back into the group. White House correspondent Patsy Wuodukuswara is there covering this G7 summit and brings us this report.
The smiles belie their differences, with an American president standing alone on many issues. First, Trump appeared to soften his stance on the China trade war.
I have second thoughts about everything.
Which his press secretary denied just a few hours later, saying the president actually regrets not raising tariffs higher. Trump insisted leaders are not pressuring him to de-escalate, a claim publicly disputed by Boris Johnson, the British prime minister seen as a potential close Trump ally due to their similar populist outlook.
But it's just a register of faint, sheep-like note of argue on the trade war. We're in favor of trade peace on the
Vying for a re-election in 2020, Trump is betting his aggressive stance on trade will garner support. He promised a trade deal with Japan in September and highlighted that Prime Minister Shinzo Abe will be buying the glut of American corn resulting from the tariff war with China, which has cost Washington billions in farm subsidies.
So perhaps you could say a couple of words just about the hundreds of millions of dollars of corn, existing corn that's there that you'll be buying.
Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif came for a surprise visit Sunday afternoon after news broke that French President Emmanuel Macron said leaders have agreed on a joint action on Iran. Trump, resisting pressure from G7 counterparts to rejoin the 2015 nuclear pact with Iran, denied the statement, prompting Macron to downplay their differences.
No.
No. He's entirely right, and I think that's what we all have to avoid media spin, where our press statements simply respond to each other.
Trump is also pushing for Russia to return after being kicked out of the G8 in 2014 over Moscow's annexation of Crimea, which it still occupies. The Europeans rejected the idea. On North Korea, Trump dismissed Japan's concern over Kim Jong-un's recent missile tests.
We're in the world of missiles, folks, whether you like it or not.
Tensions also spilled to neighboring city of Bayonne, where people marched with Macron's portrait stolen from town halls, carried upside down to protest his policies. Patsy Wuodukuswara, VOA News, Biarritz.
Well, meanwhile, a top Iranian official paid an unannounced visit Sunday to the G7 summit and headed straight toward the heart of the city where the leaders of the world's major democracies have been debating how to handle the country's nuclear ambitions. France's surprise invitation of Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif was a high-stakes gamble for French President Emmanuel Macron, who is hosting the Group of Seven gathering. Joining us with an update on this is Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. Catherine, this was definitely a pretty bold move by your president.
Bold is really one of the more diplomatic words that is being used to describe the Iranian foreign minister turning up at the G7. Others said it was risky, it was ill-advised, it was just a huge gamble. But how it turned out was this. Late last week, the Iranian foreign minister was in Europe, and on Friday he held talks with French President Emmanuel Macron at the Elysee Palace. Now, it had been sort of rumored then that Emmanuel Macron was going to try and get him to the G7, but that was all that was said. And then apparently on Saturday lunchtime at the G7, when Emmanuel Macron sat down to talk to Donald Trump in an impromptu lunch, he mentioned it. The American president apparently didn't say very much about it. It came up again then at dinner on Saturday night when all seven of the G7 leaders were there at the meeting, and it was decided among them all that, yeah, it may be not such a bad idea. And then it was quite a surprise. About 20 minutes out from landing, it appeared that the Iranian foreign minister's plane was on its way to Biarritz and was going to land at the actual site of the G7 meeting. And it really did leave everyone fumbling around. Some of the delegations, particularly the Italians, found out from the French newswire. We're not quite sure when the German chancellor knew, but she said she knew a little bit before the news media did. But certainly it does seem to have been a bold move by the French president, who has always said you cannot expect any sort of de-escalation if you stop talking to all the parties involved.
So what was he hoping to accomplish? Was there anything accomplished, and what was his goal?
First of all, the main thing is the de-escalation of tensions. He wants to have some sort of partial lifting of the oil embargo. He's only at this moment talking about the oil embargo so that there can be a guarantee that Iran will not renege further on its commitments to the nuclear deal, the JCPOA. That's all he's looking for at the moment, because he feels if you start getting that in place, then there is room for a de-escalation. On top of that, though, the French president has said that he does not want Iran to get a nuclear bomb, absolutely certain of this, but at the same time, he doesn't want an escalation of tensions in the region, and he certainly doesn't want the whole region to be destabilized. So he feels that he has got the German Chancellor Angela Merkel on his side, he's got the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson on his side. They've all said in the last few days they are committed to the Iran nuclear deal. They want that to stand. So he just hoped that he might be able to get this over the line.
And what about President Trump? Was it still pretty much a subdued reaction, or when it was all said and done, did he have any comment on that?
Up until this moment, he hasn't commented, and he's been saying all along that if others want to do outreach, that's fine, but that they do not speak on behalf of the United States. I mean, certainly there is the actual, what happened on the ground was that the Iranian foreign minister was some 500 meters away from Donald Trump, the American president, and the two just did not meet. There was nothing that happened, but there still is, at the moment, no more response from Donald Trump, no more response from his own delegation, of which his national security advisor is there. So we're just waiting to see if there's going to be a reaction. I mean, up until now, they've all gone off to dinner. It all looked relatively calm, but we're still waiting to see what will happen on Monday, when we are expecting the U.S. president and the French president to have a joint news conference.
I suppose the fact that he did not want to participate in that at all says something, that he's not really feeling that he can achieve anything by talking to Iran. So that sort of contradicts what the European leaders are hoping for, but who knows?
Yeah, indeed, who knows? It was pretty clear, even before the G7 got underway, that the French, the Germans, and the British want to see the JCPOA adhered to. I mean, even Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, within the last few hours, has said that all sides need to explore ways of reducing tensions. So they are clearly all standing firm in Europe and saying, look, the European Union is a signatory to this. They stand behind it, and they want to see it adhered to.
Were there any agreements at the end of all of it as far as meeting again or talking again?
No, absolutely nothing. Not a thing. It was a meeting that was held across the road from the main G7. Doors always been open with the Europeans. As I said, last week, the Iranian foreign minister was here in Paris. They've all been talking.
Okay.
They've all been talking between the EU. They're talking.
All right, that is Catherine Field. She is a Paris-based journalist. Thank you so much for the update. Israel says it has struck Iranian military sites in Syria to prevent what it says was a pending drone strike by Iran. Separately, Lebanon reports two Israeli drones came down in Lebanon. Some reports also say Israel was behind an airstrike in July on an arms depot in Iraq. Zlatika Hoke reports.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Sunday that any country that allows its territory to be used for aggression against Israel will face the consequences. Netanyahu spoke during a visit to the Golan Heights, hours after Israeli forces attacked what they described as Iranian bases near the Syrian capital, Damascus.
If someone rises up to kill you, kill him first. In a complicated operation by the security establishment, we learned that Iran's Quds Force dispatched a special unit of Shiite militants in Syria in order to kill Israelis on the Golan Heights with killer drones. I would like to emphasize this was an initiative of Iran, under the command of Iran, at the behest of Iran.
The Israeli army has distributed surveillance footage filmed on August 22nd, which it says is showing Iranian Quds Forces members walking near the Syrian village of Arne near Damascus with a killer drone. Iran has denied that any of its posts in Syria were hit. The Syrian government says it has intercepted Israeli missiles before they reached their targets. The British-based war monitoring group Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said an Iranian fighter and two members of the Lebanese terror group Hezbollah were among the fatalities in the strike. Meanwhile, Lebanon has accused Israel of an attack on Lebanese sovereignty following reports that two Israeli drones crashed in Beirut late Saturday. The first drone reportedly fell on the roof of the Hezbollah media office in Beirut, and the other exploded in the air and fell on an empty plot nearby. In a rare televised comment on Sunday, Hezbollah chief Hassan Nasrallah said his forces will not tolerate any further intrusions from Israel.
If we remain silent on this breach, it will create a very dangerous road for Lebanon, where every two or three days an explosive drone or suicide drone will target a certain building, farm, field, mosque, compound, and no one knows from where it comes, repeating of what is going on in Iraq now.
A U.S. official confirmed Friday that Israel had struck an arms depot in Iraq belonging to a Shiite militia with links to Iran. Two Iranian commanders were reported killed in the July attack north of Baghdad. Israel's government has not acknowledged the attack in Iraq or links to the downed drones in Beirut. But Israeli forces have attacked Hezbollah's bases in Lebanon in the past. The United States has accused Iran of supporting Hezbollah and other terrorist groups in the region. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. For women in politics, threats and harassment come with the territory. How dozens of Nigerian scammers stole millions from people and businesses. Hong Kong police have drawn their guns and arrest 36 people in the latest of continuing protests. And a blasts have injured 120 civilians this week in eastern Afghanistan. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Wildfires have been raging on in Brazil's Amazon rainforest. Environmental organizations and researchers say business interests emboldened by the country's new president are to blame. The government has authorized military intervention now. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
Saturday in Brazil, troops in the Amazon fight for the future of the blazing rainforest. Planes dropped much-needed water on a region with six states now asking for military help. Wildfires continue burning large areas of the Amazon at record pace. Flames choke the life out of trees, animals, and the air over much of South America, captured in these images from NASA satellites.
These kinds of things happen here every year. We just aren't able to tell who is responsible, but it's the same thing every year, and nobody is punished.
Environmental groups and researchers say loggers and cattle ranchers likely started the fires to clear and use the land for business. Brazil's President Jair Bolsonaro has his own theory as to who bears the blame.
In my understanding, there's a strong suspicion that it could be the people from the NGOs because they lost funding from the federal government.
Bolsonaro, despite deploying the military, insists that the fires are no worse than other years. Not so, says Brazil's space agency. Researchers registered nearly 73,000 fires so far in 2019, an 80% jump from last year. More than half of those fires are in the Amazon region. Some world leaders shared their concerns on Twitter, and French President Emmanuel Macron, who was attending the G7 meeting in France, pledged his country's support in the firefight.
L'Amazonie, c'est notre bien commun.
The Amazon is our common good. We are all concerned. First, we need to help Brazil put down these fires, and then we need to invest in reforestation and allow local inhabitants and NGO workers develop activities that will preserve this forest that we all need, because it is a treasure of our biodiversity and our climate.
The Amazon rainforest provides 20% of the world's oxygen while absorbing much of our carbon dioxide. Academics and environmental groups warn that losing the forest likely means losing the battle against climate change. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
The UN Children's Fund reports nearly 2 million children across West and Central Africa are missing out on an education because of conflict and the deliberate targeting of schools forcing their closure. Lisa Schlein reports.
The UN Children's Agency reports schools across West and Central Africa are being deliberately targeted by insurgent groups. It says an upsurge in attacks and threats of violence have forced more than 9,000 schools in the region to close since the end of 2017. UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador Muzun Al-Malayan, who has just returned from a visit to Mali, describes the suffering of the children she met as living in fear of their lives and their futures.
Many schools have been attacked, and which resulted many children out of school, which affects the future of those countries. And if we don't act now, rather than tomorrow, we cannot help those children to have access to education, which is a fundamental human right.
Al-Malayan is passionate about her mission. She is a Syrian refugee who was forced to flee her war-torn country in 2013. She spent several years in a refugee camp. Life in the camp was not easy, but she says she was able to get an education. She says this gave her hope and had a positive impact on her life. She says she wants other children in dire circumstances to have the same opportunities she has had. She tells VOA that children who have no education are vulnerable to abuse, manipulation, and exploitation.
Sometimes they are exploited sexually, or maybe they get married at such a young age. Maybe they will be also in child labor, and most dangerously when they can go for recruitment by those terrorist groups. So those terrorist groups can exploit them, can use them as child soldiers, and this can destroy their future and their lives.
UNICEF is working with authorities and communities to support alternative learning opportunities. These include community learning centers, radio school programs, and faith-based learning initiatives. The agency has appealed for $221 million to pay for educational, psychosocial support and care for school children and other essential programs in the region. It has received less than 30% of that amount. It is appealing to donors to answer its call for support in providing millions of African children with an education and a future. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And you are listening to International Edition on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. 2 years ago, Myanmar armies Myanmar's army drew international condemnation for driving more than 750,000 Muslim Rohingya into neighboring Bangladesh. This week, the Myanmar and Bangladeshi governments announced the beginning of a voluntary repatriation plan for many of them. However, not a single person volunteered to go back. Steve Sanford spoke to refugees and rights workers about the prospect of returning home amid security and rights concerns.
Tensions were running high in the Rohingya camps as a plan to begin refugee repatriation was originally set to start. Aid groups have called for returnees to be granted full citizenship and the rights that come with it. But critics say little has changed since the crisis started.
Rohingya that return will be confined to transit centers for a number of days, and they'll be forced to take NVC cards, national verification cards. National verification cards do not give the Rohingya the right to self-identify as Rohingya, and they're based off a discriminatory law, the 1982 citizenship law.
The Refugee Relief and Repatriation Commission reports that a total of 295 families have been surveyed so far, but no one was willing to return to Myanmar. The results were no surprise for most in the crowd, and one Rohingya father was still unclear why he was on the initial list of 3,450 potential returnees surveyed.
In Myanmar, my brother and relatives have been jailed. The Burmese must release them first before we return. They must accept us as Rohingya and give us our dignity back. That's all we ask from the Myanmar government. If they give us that, we will return on our own. They don't need to come pick us up.
It was a sentiment shared by many refugees, including Seidel Mustafa.
My Rohingya brothers are living in Myanmar refugee camp, IDB camp. They have not got right. Well, it's not. So how can they are repatriation me from Bangladesh? If they are willing to repatriation us, at first they need to clear about IDB camp.
A UN fact-finding mission has concluded that the Myanmar military intended to perpetrate genocide on the Rohingya when it drove hundreds of thousands of them from the country. And the idea of refugees lining up to return home remains a non-starter. Steve Sanford for VOA News in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh.
The first official comic book convention, or Comic-Con for short, happened in New York in 1964. And since then, the world of comic books has moved to TV, the movies, video games, and these conventions have become huge events. We visited one to get a feel for how they work. VOA's Tanya Iman reports.
In San Diego, this year's Comic-Con celebration was special. They held their first 50 years ago. Since its humble beginnings, Comic-Cons have become pop culture festivals, moving way beyond comics to movies, video games, and TV shows, as well as good old comic books.
A lot of people are having a lot of fun. There's a lot of cool things that are out there, and a lot of the companies are doing what they can to make it the most enjoyable yet.
For this year's San Diego Comic-Con, 100,000 people made the trip to San Diego to visit, include Farah from Indonesia.
I can't believe there is a pop culture festival this big that attracts people from around the world.
Part of the draw for many people are the people who dress up as their favorite characters from the movies, video games, or comic books. They're called cosplayers, and they are a big part of the appeal of this event.
There's so much activity and energy, and everyone's really into the fandoms and showing their support, and it's awesome. The energy is just awesome.
I mean, I've made a couple of cosplays. This one is kind of intermediate. You know, I had to do a lot of shopping around, you know, pick up some supplies, order stuff.
This costume took about 8 months to complete, from original proof of concept to carving, plus all the electronics inside of the entire suit.
Since their humble beginnings, Comic-Cons have exploded, and there are hundreds of them held every year in at least 26 different countries. Dania Iman, Ronan Zakaria, VOA News, San Diego.
As the summer movie season winds down, another mid-budget release slides into the number one spot at the box office. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
The president's top guardian angel has fallen.
Don't you see that I'm being set up?
Angel Has Fallen overcame harsh reviews to attract the biggest crowds in theaters this weekend, earning more than $21 million in its debut.
The president's not safe.
It's the third in the Fallen series, starring Gerard Butler.
I'm not gonna stop until I prove who did this.
There's so many girls at the party. You know what that means?
Drama.
No, kissing.
The R-rated comedy Good Boys slides to second with an estimated $11.8 million, while the Christian film Overcomer opens in third with $8 million. I'm Ben Thomas.
Well, musician Eddie Money has announced that he has stage 4 esophageal cancer. AP music correspondent Margie Sarzaletta reports.
Eddie Money says it hit him really, really hard when he learned he had cancer. He says in a video released from his Access TV reality series Real Money that the cancer is in his liver, lymph nodes, and stomach. Money, who is 70, had a heart valve procedure in May and pneumonia in July. He says he wants to be honest about his diagnosis. He also wants people to know that cancer has come a long way and not everyone dies from it like they did in the 50s and 60s. He says he doesn't know if he's going to live a long time, but he'll take every day he can get. The full episode runs on Access TV on September 12th. I'm Archie Zaraletta.
And the Obama summer playlist is everyone from Drake and Beyonce to Steely Dan and Frank Sinatra. The former president calls it some new, some old, some fast, and some slow. AP correspondent Julie Walker has the story.
Day after day, I'm more confused.
Dobby Gray's version of Drift Away is one of the 44 songs Barack and Michelle Obama have been listening to this summer. The former president tweeted out his playlist, which also contains Drake's Too Good and the Sinatra standard, I've Got You Under My Skin, as well as Steely Dan's Reelin' in the Years.
Are you reelin' in the years?
Other choices are Mood Forever, the Lion King song with Beyonce and Jay-Z, among other artists, and such oldies as Van Morrison's Brown Eyed Girl. I'm Julie Walker.
Are you reelin' in the years?
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The right to own property is key to fully integrating women into a nation's economy. Speaking on a Women's Global Development and Prosperity Initiative panel, better known as WGDP, to announce new projects, advisor to the President Ivanka Trump noted that changing property and inheritance laws may be the most critical step in ensuring women's full and free participation in local economies. USAID Administrator Mark Green also affirmed the importance of land rights in women's economic empowerment. We talk about the journey to self-reliance and helping countries lead themselves, he said. No country is self-reliant if it isn't tapping into more than half of its population. CEO Chris Jochnik from Landesa, an NGO that is implementing a land rights project, said WGDP funds put in Liberia, Mozambique, Zambia, Tanzania, and Ethiopia will ensure women's property rights through revised laws and regulations. The project will affect the ability of millions of women to own, inherit, or use land across Africa. Approximately 100 million women live in these five countries, said Mr. Jochnik, and this project should go a long way to bolstering their entrepreneurship and economic opportunities. There are 90 countries where, either by law or by custom, women can't own, inherit, or manage land. As a consequence, these women are relegated to second-class citizenship and life in a constant state of vulnerability.
If we want to empower women, we have to start with this fundamental inequity. Most people living in poverty, most women living in poverty, live off the land. Land to them is a home, survival, an income, a chance to feed and clothe and house and educate their children. Land is also a chance for entrepreneurship.
A recent success story is Côte d'Ivoire, where a new marriage law will now enable women to inherit and acquire property, said Advisor Trump.
This
built upon great work being done on a local level, actually through funding with local NGOs and advocates in Côte d'Ivoire, MCC. I visited there this spring and reinforced the essential nature of changing this law.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is V.